Okay, we're going to start session 165, and this session is on reasons for technological interpretations of Mormonism, and our main presenter will be Lincoln Cannon, that I'll introduce right now, and then we have a respondent that I'll introduce after Lincoln's remarks. A little bit of biographical information about Lincoln is that he has 14 years of professional experience in general management, software engineering and information technology, working in the medical device and software industries, companies such as Merit Medical and Symantec. He holds a master's degree in business administration and a bachelor's degree in philosophy at Brigham Young University. In his spare time, Lincoln promotes awareness of philosophical implications of emerging technologies, which is a euphemism that if you find him on Facebook, he'll friend you. And serves as president of the Mormon Transhumanist Association. So we'll let Lincoln present his paper at this point in time, and then I'll introduce the rest of it.
Thanks.
So how often have we heard that question represented in that picture? Are science and religion compatible? And yet, how many of us are still waiting for the answer? What are we waiting for? Do we expect someone will discover or reveal the answer? Could it be discovered or revealed without begging the question? For example, can we use science to answer a question about science without already assuming its axioms and its methods? Likewise, for religion, can we use it to answer a question about itself without starting from faith? What about technology and spirituality? Who decided that hope, healing, and heaven must be supernatural? How are so many of us persuaded that we can experience the spiritual but not measure it? And that we can promote such experience but not manage it with greater precision? When did we convince ourselves that machines must be cold metal and hollow plastic, forever in contrast with the warmth and the beauty of the human soul? Today, I contend that Mormons can and should affirm the compatibility of religion, science, spirituality, and technology. I'll present a brief interpretation of Mormon scripture and tradition, particularly their descriptions of how the universe and our bodies work, in terms of contemporary science and technological trends. Of course, further research will prove my interpretation to be inaccurate to some extent, but that's okay. The purpose of the interpretation is only to illustrate the possibility of technological interpretations generally, as context for my more serious interest, which is to identify some practical and moral reasons for which we all should adopt technological interpretations of our religion. Mormon physics, as expounded in scripture and by prominent authorities, lends itself to interpretations compatible with the methods and the axioms of science. So I'll give you a brief example. Mormon physics posits objectivity through materialism and empiricism. Everything is matter. Coarse matter is element. Fine matter is spirit, primal intelligence, or the light of truth in and through all things. All matter is eternal, uncreated and indestructible, but malleable. God, a material being, either emerged from or was organized out of chaotic matter, and then continued to organize this matter, first spirit, then element, iteratively. All matter, including spirit, is discernible. Experience leads to knowledge. Knowledge leads to truth, which is contextual and dynamic. If we seek, nothing will be withheld. Mormon physics also posits consistency, causality, and uniformity. Innumerable systems exist in space and time and all have laws. Laws may differ from one system to another, and some systems may govern others. Recurrently, without definite beginning, God instituted laws within the context of previous laws, and according to knowledge of those laws. Likewise, we will attain no greater heaven than that we make according to law. Faith without knowledge and works will not save us. Blessings are predicated by law. Even miracles, although marvelous in our eyes, do not contravene law. If we will seek, we can understand all mysteries. Similarly, Mormon physiology lends itself to interpretations compatible with technological trends projected into hypothetical futures. When new processes may change the composition of our bodies into new configurations. Again, I'll provide a brief example, noting that some of the ideas are speculative and merit more explanation than I can provide now. So the example. Mormonism posits intelligence, spirits, and souls as physiological components and describes them in a manner consistent with existence in a computational substrate. Intelligence, or the light of truth, existed without beginning. It can be organized into spirits, increased for advantage or decreased according to desire. Spirits can become souls when organized into bodies of element. These structures of light and element may be constantly computing and broadcasting truth about themselves as their contribution to an aggregated reality. Perhaps they exhibit their primitive intelligence in quantum uncertainty. We may be learning to create them when we write simple computer programs. Maybe even God computes us. Mormonism also posits physiological processes of transfiguration and resurrection, describing them in ways that align with hypotheses of radical life extension and detailed computer emulation. During the millennium, mortals will be changed and the dead raised to immortality. The ordinance of transfiguration will be revealed in the last times, and the ordinance of resurrection will be administered by immortals. Accordingly, if biotechnology manages to prevent or to repair aging, we may enjoy indefinitely long and healthy lifespans. Subsequently, given enough computing power, we may even be able to emulate in full detail all persons who have ever lived. Finally, Mormonism posits immortality and glories as physiological configurations and describes them as we might describe mind and body enhancements. The inhabitants of innumerable worlds vary in glory, knowledge, and power according to their desires. Celestial beings, like us, differ in glory as do the stars. Terrestrial beings exceed the telestial. Celestial beings attain the creative capacity of gods and learn of yet higher glories. Accordingly, we see technology becoming increasingly intimate. Surgeries, drugs, and prosthetics repair and enhance our capacities. Computers that once filled warehouses are now embedded in our bodies. Perhaps the day will come when biological and information systems merge and thoughts create worlds like our own. So what? Why should we care that technological interpretations of Mormonism are even possible? Why should you care that I can give you an example of one like I have? To answer this question, I've identified some practical and moral reasons that I hope will persuade you, if you're not already persuaded, to adopt a technological interpretation of your religion. Can works save you? Christians debate whether good works are necessary for salvation, with responses ranging from the extremes of Calvinism, salvation does not depend on our efforts, to the extremes of Pelagianism, salvation depends almost entirely on our efforts. Most Christians situate themselves somewhere between the extremes, but where should we situate ourselves? Here's a wager: bet on better works. In any choice between ideologies, choose the one that you think will affect you to evidence better works. To the extent Calvinism is accurate, your choice won't matter. To the extent Pelagianism is accurate, your better works will save you. Even for broad understandings of salvation and good works, the wager stands. For example, Should we trust that benevolent power will make us happy? From a pseudo-Calvinist perspective, it wouldn't matter because something beyond our benevolent power will determine our happiness. So to the extent pseudo-Calvinism is accurate, it can't hurt to bet on benevolent power. As another example, should we trust that ethical technology will increase our utility? From a pseudo-Pelagianist perspective, our utility depends on our ethical technology. So to the extent pseudo-Pelagianism is accurate, ethical technology is a good bet. So the relation between good works and salvation, however defined, however understood, must be one of the following. Number one, they don't have a causal relation. Or, number two, they have a negative causal relation. Or number three, they have a positive causal relation. Number one, that they don't have a causal relation, is of no practical consequence by definition. Practice is limited to works, even if broadly understood as power or technology. If good works are no more likely to cause salvation than our evil works, then it doesn't matter whether we reject number one, even if we're wrong. Common sense rejects number two, as it should, again based on definitions. We don't hear anyone argue seriously that good works cause damnation because it's internally contradictory. That leaves us with number three. We should trust that good works cause salvation. Bet on better works. In any choice between ideologies, choose the one that you think will affect you to evidence better works. If there's anything you can do to achieve salvation, you will have done it. Or as expressed by President Dieter Uchtdorf, when our wagon gets stuck in the mud, God is much more likely to assist the man who gets out to push than the man who merely raises his voice in prayer, no matter how eloquent the oration. Human ideologies are information systems. Like computer information systems, which help us act sensibly within an environment of networked computers, ideologies help us act sensibly in our complex world. Although far richer than computer information systems, ideologies are still systems of interrelated symbols, codes, laws, words, and so forth. Also like information systems, which rely on integration programs to share data between them, ideologies are often unable to exchange ideas without assistance from an integrating or syncretizing ideology. In addition to its distinct strengths, Mormonism can serve as an integration between two powerful ideologies, Judeo-Christian religion and Enlightenment philosophy that gave rise to modern science. A technological interpretation of Mormonism can readily map symbols from each of these ideologies into symbols in the other. For example, the God of Judeo-Christian religion may map into Enlightenment philosophy as a creative and benevolent post-human. And Enlightenment philosophy's expected future of dramatic increases in human knowledge and power may map into Judeo-Christian religion as the millennium. Integrations can be complex and messy. Sometimes data in one symbol system doesn't map well into the other system. Sometimes integrators make poor implementation decisions. Always, an integration can be improved as the integrators become increasingly familiar with the systems they're integrating. This is also true of technological interpretations of Mormonism, whose mappings between the Judeo-Christian religion and Enlightenment philosophy present various limitations and opportunities for improvement. Yet, beyond limitations, the integrated ideologies enable us to leverage the strengths of each with less difficulty. Mormons that embrace technological interpretations of their religion will find it easier to embrace science while maintaining a fulfilling relationship with their spiritual education and religious community. Moreover, by embracing technological interpretations, we're doing a better job of living our religion, as expressed by Joseph Smith. One of the grand fundamental principles of Mormonism is to receive truth, let it come from whence it may. Mormonism is, on principle, an integrating ideology. Mormons almost universally acknowledge that we have an obligation and capacity to participate in the work of God, to bring about the immortality and eternal life of humanity. This acknowledgement focuses primarily on the advance of spiritual salvation, particularly through missionary and temple work. Such a focus is important, but it does not in itself satisfy the full extent of our obligation, which also includes the advance of physical salvation. Both the LDS Church and individual Mormons regularly demonstrate real concern and concerted effort to advance physical salvation through means ranging from neighborhood service projects to large-scale welfare and humanitarian programs. Yet we can and we should do more. Each day, around 150,000 persons die. Many of them die of painful and debilitating diseases. Most of them die from something that is not commonly considered a disease, although it is altogether as painful and debilitating. It emaciates our muscles and bones, makes our hair fall out, blurs our vision, and stifles our hearing. Finally, if it doesn't kill us by clogging our hearts or setting off runaway cellular growth, it steals our memories. We become accustomed to this inexorable degradation, which, of course, we call aging. In the Book of Mormon, we read of Jesus asking 12 Nephite disciples what they desire. 9 tell him that they desire to teach the gospel for the remainder of their lives and then quickly ascend to heaven. Jesus tells them that they are blessed for this desire. The remaining 3 are hesitant to express their desire, but Jesus discerns that they would like to go on teaching the gospel without ever dying. He then tells them that they are more blessed for this desire. Here, Jesus affirms that God is a God of life, and that death, with hell, is indeed an awful monster, as described by Nephi. More blessed than those who would die for Christ are those who would, if possible, live for Christ. The message of this Book of Mormon passage is particularly pertinent today, while we are learning through modern science and technology to extend and enhance life. There are some who argue that it's immoral to extend human life indefinitely. There are others who see such power as an endowment from God and as means of deliverance from Nephi's awful monster. Will we, like the 3 Nephites, be more blessed by making use of the means provided? Or will we sit still, supposing that God will deliver us despite our apathy? Perhaps desire for life, expressed in our actions, will bring for us the prophesied day of transfiguration, when mortal lives will be as the age of a tree. There is no death, and we are changed in the twinkling of an eye. Science and religion are compatible, not necessarily because of any discovery or revelation, although those may abound in our perspectives. Rather, science and religion are compatible because we can and should make them compatible. It's primarily a matter of choice. It may require some humility and willingness to acknowledge that we don't already have the best understandings of one or the other, but it's in our interest, both practically and morally. God willing, we'll enjoy some things that are even better when we mix them together. Thank you.
Our respondent today is J. Mark Olson, who has a PhD from the University of Utah and specializes in ethics and psychiatry and therapeutic practice. He's an instructor at Westminster College.
Well, I want to begin by thanking Lincoln for his excellent paper. I think that transhumanism generally, and in particular your paper raises some issues I think we need to be dealing with right now. The reason that we need to be dealing with them, and I hope that my response, which is I actually have prepared and written here, I hope that it gets at the reasons we need to be dealing with these issues and why they're important. I do want to say before I begin that Lincoln's paper deals with a lot of theology and a lot of ideas in Mormonism. I'm actually not going to touch on it. My main interest and what I think is most morally salient right now is what we do with the technology that's on the horizon. And it's I think we both would agree. I mean, we're on the cusp of some very, very exciting things. I think we need to be thinking about what we're going to do with them. So let me read my remarks. I may make some comments as I go through this. The 20th century, we're often telling ourselves, has seen a surge in technological development that exceeds that of any prior age. My own grandfather chased the first automobile to rumble down the streets of Holbæk, Denmark, all the while throwing rocks at the mechanical beasts. He also lived to see men walk on the moon, the perennial symbol of technological achievement, and to see computers in nearly every American home. Nevertheless, the rise of technology also has led some to question the wisdom of the world so permeated with, to use the Aristotelian terms, the artificial. Some of us embrace technology while others eschew it. Transhumanists like Lincoln are surely in the former camp, while many others, and the number is growing daily, are skeptical of technology's ability to solve our problems. Surely there are technological successes, but failures too, some of which we could never have anticipated at the time the technology was manufactured. Frankly, I'm not terribly pleased with the dichotomy, and my own position is one that sees trouble on either side. However, I'm not here to expand my own position, but to say something about Lincoln's. Let me begin by saying that too often the charges leveled against the transhumanists and other advocates of biological technology are really non-sequiturs, straw men, or other misconstrues of the transhumanist position. Transhumanism does not necessarily, as far as I understand it, imply that humans will build the kind of futuristic society depicted in books like Brave New World or films like Gattaca. Right. Okay. There may be some danger that the technology we're playing around with here will create inherent inequities in the future if some have access to the technology and some do not. And I do have some worries about that. But I see these problems as ancillary to the bigger question, which is whether there is anything inherently wrong with human enhancement generally. The fact is, and those who favor human enhancement or want to point this out, we already create serious dichotomies through practices that are not so technologically advanced. The problem is disparity, and here I'm thinking about sending your kids to really good schools, whereas some people don't get the opportunity to do that. If we have the opportunity to genetically enhance our kids and some people don't, then we've got like H.G. Wells' Time Machine. The warlocks live underground and the smart people live up in the, there are worries about this kind of thing. And I don't think it's fair to say to level these against transhumanists. Okay. I think there is something, though, about genetic technology that may deepen those disparities if they exist. And I do worry about that, but that's not my main worry here. So I'm going to acknowledge that. I also might be tempted to take issue with the explicit use of utilitarian ethic, which I think, am I right in thinking that that's, utilitarian ethic is somewhere in the background in your thought there? We're trying to make
probably
everybody...
Probably not.
Probably not? Okay, well... Then
but
I'm
it depends on how you define the utilitarian.
Okay, okay.
It sounded like it to me.
Huh?
It sounded like it to me.
That's what I got when I read the paper. But I'm not going to worry about that either. What I'd rather address is the difficult and essential question of what role technology ought to play in shaping ourselves. That it does play such a role cannot be denied. This is where I think a lot of people get transhumanism wrong. We have become the kind of beings we are today in large part due to the use of technology, and on almost anyone's view, there's no problem with this. No matter how organic the food you eat is, no matter how small your ecological footprint, you definitely benefit from the use of the artificial. hoes, shovels, picks, saws, and much more technology, are as much technology as airplanes or nuclear power plants. We are deeply and inherently technological beings. Furthermore, I am as comfortable as Lincoln, I think, with the notion that our technology should stay only outside of us. That can't be right. Furthermore, I am as uncomfortable with Lincoln, I think, with the notion that our technology should stay only outside of us and not venture into the realm of the human/biological. Vaccination for polio and smallpox has done great good in the world, while many externally applied technologies, here think of the Union Carbide leak in Bhopal, India, has done some incredible damage. I'm not even sure if our quest to become better should be restricted to those parts of us that are outside the nucleus of our cells. Germline therapy could end tragically debilitating and fatal diseases like Tay-Sachs syndrome and Huntington's disease. And I have trouble seeing any downside to that. However, I do understand the worry on the other side. We humans are prone to see ourselves as the producers of the artificial, as the manufacturer, not as the product. Well, the line between, and this is, I think, very important. This makes this a very tricky issue. Well, the line between creator and created is thin in the field of biotechnology. We think that we still discern a distinction. The elimination of polio undermines a crippling disease. Augmenting athletic ability or increasing age looks more to us like manufacturing itself. Although I'm not that worried about increasing age. Whatever. Some of us balk at this kind of use of biotechnology because we fear that the distinction between the natural and the artificial will be pushed until it breaks. We like the idea of using technology to make us well, but we fear the use of technology to manufacture persons like us. This is what disturbs us about germline therapy in particular. We still see ourselves as essentially organic, not as manufactured. The problem with genetic enhancement is that it calls to mind persons as artifacts. We become the product, not the craftsman. Persons find this scary, and maybe they should. This is not to say that where the line between manufacturer and manufacturer is easy to draw. Part of what makes this an extra tricky problem is that the line between eliminating illness within cells and creating completely new kinds of cells is a very fuzzy one. When distinctions are fine and borders are fuzzy, it is tempting to run to one extreme or the other. Hence, there are plenty of folks who eschew any form of technology that has arisen since the 19th century, and there are those like Lincoln who embrace just about anything science can do, so long as we do it righteously, right, Lincoln? Okay. One can hold, however, that neither of these views gets the right ethic for this brave new world. We might instead hold that we should proceed with caution, allow ourselves to think through what it is we want to make of ourselves. If we really worry about manufacturing cells, even if that manufacturing moves us into a transhuman period, then we have got to proceed with extreme caution, taking an extra special effort in the process of our transition. We, after all, might actually be on the brink of having the capacity to make human cells that are significantly unlike the human cells that walk our planet now. Persons who age as trees, who are not prone to depression, to bipolar disorder, who have an aggressive aptitude for music, who are excellent farmers, engineers, teachers, and pilots, who are all perfectly physically fit, have perfect skin and glistening hair. That is the potential, at least, of our enhanced future. It is right to ask ourselves whether we want that future, whether or not it is better that we have a future where the self is a product of our hands, and whether there is something valuable in the selves that are more subject to the natural lottery as they are now. This brings me back to the theology that Lincoln presents in his paper. If creating the most happiness for the most people isn't... I may have got you wrong here, so we... You know, I guess we hold off on whether this is a criticism at all. Is the only moral goal worth attaining, then there cannot really be an objection to Lincoln's proposal. Not all of us are happy with that moral picture. I'm particular because I have deep Kantian sympathies. some of us are more concerned with honoring and respecting the humanity and autonomy of individuals. The Kantian worry in cases like these is that using technology to manufacture selves would be tantamount to making persons to serve ends we choose for them. Now, admittedly, this is a tricky objection to Lincoln's thesis, since the enhanced individual is arguably the freer individual. However, the enhanced individual is also an individual whose agency is expanded by making them an object of other selves, and that is at least more morally problematic in itself. Folks like Lincoln could, of course, claim that enhancements that expand agency could not be enhancements that take the person as an artifact, but I don't think this is the case. Now, this is a tricky argument. We may want to talk about the discussion. I don't know if you want to talk about anything else. That's fine, too. But, think of this kind of case. Suppose I make a robot and endow it with great rational ability, along with the ability to think and deliberate on its own, and then I give it a great ability for doing physics, astronomy, and a passion for football, and a deep love for horseback riding and mountain climbing. Now, the robot is not restricted from other kinds of activities and may learn to love some, but she is more likely to prefer those that I have enhanced her to have. She's more powerfully, in fact, able to pursue these interests than she is others, and in that way she is capable of greater autonomy. Enhancement has this implication. It must implant possibilities and abilities in the individual. There is no other enhancement. There is no other way enhancement can work. Now, if we implant these abilities, then we are, to that extent, altering the person who receives the enhanced self. Now, I recognize this is problematic, because we may be doing the same thing when we give somebody an artificial limb, right? But the fact is that there is a fuzzy line here between fixing a problem and enhancing a person, so we've literally made a different kind of self. And that's the worry I have. The line will always be fuzzy, but, and that drives philosophers nuts, but it's important, I think, that we talk about and think about where we want to draw these lines. Is this a real worry? Yes. We should absolutely be concerned about how we use technology with this kind of power. We may well be on the brink of technology that could seriously alter our lives by fundamentally changing our very selves. And that is scary and dangerous business. And to be clear, I think it is inherently dangerous business and not the dangerous extension of something inherently harmless. We may well be on the verge of having the capacity to manufacture our very selves. Nothing could be more serious. Does what I have said here mean that we should rule out any particular enhancement technology altogether? I don't think so. A lot of work is being done right now. In fact, Lincoln mentions this more than any other particular technology he mentions, but on expanding human lifespans, for instance, it's very preliminary work, but it's really interesting what they're doing, for instance, in rats, right? I mean, this is really fascinating stuff. I'm rather unsure if this is a morally problematic project. I don't know. I'm not sure that it is at all. What if giving children extra fingers for playing the piano in superhuman ways? That does come up in Gattaca, right there. This was made for 22-fingered, you know. Okay. Or genes that increase the likelihood that a child will have a great athletic ability, or genes that augment other physical characteristics, or perhaps inserting genes that would allow minors to glow in the dark, and that wouldn't be that hard. Really? No, you're laughing. It really wouldn't.
They already do it with that
one. Yeah, they already do it with that. And this, I don't think that one would be particularly dangerous to do to humans either. I think it'd be weird, right? But it would not be particularly dangerous. Okay. And it might save mining companies a lot of money, right? Okay. I'm decidedly less enthusiastic about these later technologies. While such technology may open doors, they also make us very much the product of our scientific endeavors. This is more or less what I take Kurzweil to mean by the singularity, the point at which the self becomes a product. I do not think we should all be comfortable with the idea. Nevertheless, I'm not sure we should be able to stop it once it comes. Which is why, in my view, it is essential we have the discussion and we have it now. It may be that not all the technology that will bring about the singularity will come to fruition. However, some of it is upon us. There is no doubt of that. Given that it is upon us, I think we ought to welcome the discussion. We are the ones who will, after all, decide what brave new world we will embrace and what we will reject. And I thank those who, like Lincoln, raise the question in good faith.
Thanks, Mark.
Well, in the spirit of technology, the old school low technology, all the pens were missing, and so I sent myself an email to rent the movie Gattaca. I haven't watched that one yet. And during the presentation, I had some disagreements with what Lincoln had to say, so I unfriended him, and I sent a friend request. So, also, there was one part that I disagreed with a little bit. You quoted Oopdorf, and I think we should take every opportunity to correct that where we can, because, yeah, I think he has a really difficult name to pronounce, and he looks so damn handsome, it makes the rest of us feel inferior. So the thing that I disagreed with, if you're turning around and pushing the cart, or your car or whatever, if God only answers the prayers for people who, answers best the prayers for people who gets out of the car and pushes the car, then if we're doing all the work, then the only work that God's really doing is in our own imagination that he's helping us. And so I kind of disagree with that, and he does look way too handsome and makes me feel inferior. So on a more serious note, the question I thought of initially when I was listening to your presentation is the idea that we come from, that intelligence exists there and that God organizes, God didn't organize, but intelligence into spirits at some point in time, and then they became, then we inherited bodies at that point in time and then kept progressing. How much is there of, have you really thought about, or do you have any comment on the idea that there is there an unlimited amount of unorganized intelligence that we'll tap into someday in order to create spirits from, or at some point in time, does this hierarchy of unorganized spirits, people, humans, men, gods of gods, etc., will we run out of that resource at some point in day? Then you can go on and we'll go with the first question after that.
Of course, the honest answer to your question is I have no idea. But, you know, I enjoy speculating about things like that. I'm very much a materialist. For me, you know, as Joseph said, spirit is matter. I don't even insist that... Who's in this room? I don't even insist that the traditional understanding of the consciousness of those organized spirits is necessary to our interpretation of Scripture. Fine, if it's there, I don't know. I'm comfortable either way. So what did God do? He created, in my estimation, he created a world. And I get at that estimation based on some interesting reasoning that I've presented at Sunstone before and have some handouts for in the back corner of the room if you want to grab them after. It's called the New God Argument. And but basically, I think the answer to the question, in short, is that it's indefinite. Not infinite, not finite. I just don't know, and I'm not sure that God knows. And there's actually reasons that I have to believe that even God might not know the answer to your question. So go read about the New God Argument.
Mine is a kind of a comment on some of Mark's response. So Mark asks, you know, whether encourages us to consider the question of whether we really want this potential future of perfect physical specimens who are long-lived, who have all kinds of, you know, skills in all kinds of areas and so forth. But from a Mormon perspective, it seems to me that this is a no-brainer. Of course we do, because that's exactly how most, if not all, Mormons envision the celestial kingdom. Eternal youth, perfect bodies, perfect skills, etc. And similarly, pretty much all of the objections or potential objections to enhancements that we might make and the consequences of those seem equally applicable to becoming gods and doing that sort of thing, creating worlds and creating people and all those kinds of things, or even God's interventions now. And I wonder if you have a reaction to that.
Absolutely. To speak to that, it's almost impossible to speak that without actually speaking to some of the theology. And that's hard for me to do because I'm not a trained theologian. But I will say this, and I thought about putting some of this in the paper. I suppose in some ways it depends on how you want to see God, divinity, and the salvation. It's possible to see God on this sort of metaphor as God in the lab coat, right? It's also possible to see, and this will only defend my position in the sense that, from the theological point of view, I suppose, in the sense that it should make sense to you where I'm coming from. I don't think that it's a response that will undermine the other side, but it's possible to see God, especially in light of what Lincoln has said here about natural law. It's possible to see God instead as a sort of gardener qua or father, where a lot of what's going on in natural law, we exist within this sort of order, and the order is organic. And there are certain parts we can manipulate artificially using technology, and there are other parts that just proceed. Maybe I'm a little more comfortable with the latter. If I'm more comfortable with the latter, then salvation may be something more organic and less artificial. That we participate in a more organic and a less technological sort of way. I think some of us are more comfortable with that view, but I am not going to do any more than gesture at the view, and I'm not going to defend the view. But I think if you're going to get down to the sort of theological questions that underlie some of my criticisms, it probably lies there.
All right, I have less questions than critiques, but I guess I'll go with Lincoln first. I don't think that there can be really a Mormon transhumanism so much as Mormons who are transhumanists, because the vast majority of arguments you provided, I think, are utilitarian in nature and are largely based upon the maximization of human pleasure, enjoyment, and other goods, like, you know, a lifespan in which you can make, you know, self-actualized decisions and things like that. But the idea that you can superimpose a lot of the goals and the hopes of transhumanism over the theology of Mormonism, I think, is misguided, because there's nothing foundational to any of Joseph Smith's experiences which would lead us to this sort of technological interpretation. It's pretty clear that even though he makes overtures for materialism, I'm pretty sure he conceives of the spiritual world as something that he can ascertain through reason, but that's pretty separate from everyday experience. He seems to be more along the lines of Emanuel Swedenborg, you know, where there are these separate substances, and, you know, there are laws that run them. But the project seems extremely foreign to Mormonism. You know, it seems almost more of a schism than a, you know, overlay. So that would be my main criticism. Also,
would you like me to respond to that one before you go to the another one?
Or I wait if you prefer. I won't respond to the specifics, except I'll respond to something that I think should give you pause to reconsider. Many religious persons have attempted to organize transhumanist organizations with religious or spiritual bents to them. And they've been quite unsuccessful. The Mormon Transhumanist Association is the largest group of transhumanists, not even just religious transhumanists, in North America. And it's well known among the secular transhumanists, the influential ones, as being the model of of trying to promote transhumanist ideas among religious people. And they keep wondering why it doesn't work with other religions. And I think that that the reason it does work so well and so easily among Mormons is that there is more in Mormonism that resonates quite strongly with transhumanism than you're allowing for. So just not responding directly, but indirectly giving you maybe a reason to consider it a little bit more about what there might be going on that makes those two things resonate so much for so many people.
I definitely agree with you that formally, like with our conceptions of deification and those surrounding ideas, it makes sense that we would become something else, something that's normally considered alien to humanity, you know, God. So I sympathize with those impulses, but I still think that foundationally, it's more of a contrivance than a sort of organic development.
It's artificial, technology.
Yeah, it just doesn't. Most people conceive of revelation not so much as like mind uploading or a reinstantiation of a mental simulation in God's mind. You know, those are extremely
flawed. Most people have no idea how inspiration works on a biological level, right?
That's true too.
Okay. So, anyway, what's your next question?
Use the mind thing.
Oh, sorry.
I think I'll just go to Mark. I'm interested in that sort of Kantian objection, because I view humans as products anyway. We're products of evolution and the forces that we can't control, and you should at least have some feeling that as a teacher you're changing your students in ways that they may not want to be changed, right? That you're forcing them to respond to challenges that they may not have chosen of themselves. So do you feel like that Kantian objection to transhumanism generally might apply even to any sort of schooling or, you know, tutelage?
No. And but that's tricky. I mean, and look, one of the things I really appreciate about this paper is that about what Lincoln's doing in transhumanists, I suppose, generally, is that it does get us into really tricky areas. Because you know, you're right. I mean, if enhancing persons is and even changing them in as you said, ways that they're uncomfortable with, if that's messing with their autonomy and it goes against their projects, and if that undercuts a kind of Kantian position, then we've proved too much. I mean, that's really the way the criticism goes. So we would need some kind of principled reason to say this counts as undercutting autonomy in ways that are not permissible, and this counts as undercutting autonomy in ways that are permissible. Or this may be undercutting autonomy, but it's so, you know, in the end, a person ends up embracing the projects that they wouldn't have embraced before they heard about, I don't know, euthanasia or something, you know. They hear about it in a class in a way that suddenly they come, oh my gosh, yeah, you're right, I believe in physician-assisted suicide, I'm moving to Amsterdam, so I can, you know. I don't have the principle for you today, but that's why I think some of these issues are, I think they are very tricky, and I think too often the criticisms leveled against this kind of thing are dismissive, and I don't think they grapple with how tricky an issue this really is. So, I guess I have a kind of explicit faith that there is a principle distinction. Unfortunately, I'm not prepared to give it to you today. So,
so you just think that there's some line somewhere that one day we may be able to demarcate?
The boundary may be fuzzy, but that doesn't mean, you know, if you look at philosophical problems that have to do with, you know, heaps, fuzzy boundaries don't mean that we can just embrace whatever point on the dichotomy, you know, that there aren't moral problems with embracing certain points along the line, right?
Thanks so much for bringing up these questions. They're so interesting. But I think the one thing that troubles me most is the idea that inequality is ancillary to our main questions. I think that that's very possible in this room because probably no one in this room has borne the full cost of the technology which they use. And so I'm wondering, if we're going to be good materialists, why are we speaking about technology as an abstraction and the problem, this Kantian sensibilities? Let's talk about where materially our technology comes from. And if we're talking about objections to inequality, let's not talk about a science fiction movie, but actually the lives of people daily involved, and there's more of them every year, daily involved in the mining, milling, manufacturing, and waste disposal of the technology that we're currently using. Give us some comments. So I've been researching women in the global south, and this is a recurring question, this idea that the technology we're using as gadgets, and they improve our lives in a variety of ways, but they're not improving the lives of a huge swath of humanity, and their lives are actually being burdened by our technological uses. And so the question is, if someone is able to live so forever, who are those people going to be? I would posit that they would be white and wealthy. And that's a huge problem. That's far more troubling to me than someone having more fingers. And so the question for me is, as you ended your discussion about how we are the ones who get to decide what will this brave new world will be like, who is included in the we, and how do we expand that conversation?
So you want me to address?
Go ahead.
That would be great. Okay. That is an amazingly good question. And I gestured at some of those problems, because I wanted to get at the... we are dealing with those problems now. And the disparity question is, if you know the literature about enhancement, it's one of the bigger issues that underlies some of these questions. As a kind of practical moral issue, you could say, hey, look, we already allow people to send their kids to private schools, and they can enhance their kids in ways that. That involve disparity in all kinds of ways. Why not? Do we really want to extend that into their DNA and all this kind of... These are really, really important questions. And then you go beyond that and talk about... when you talk about the environment and... the way we're sort of tearing up the environment to in order to bring about a sort of wonderful technological future was. It turns out, if you look at it one way, this is a wonderful technological future for about 20% of us, and the rest of us are, starving to death, and they're not really benefiting. And these are important issues. Do you know how expensive? If you just take the example that you're using about life. Expanding is that development will be really expensive for that stuff. Do you know what the projections are for once it?
Nobody knows how complex it's going to be.
I suppose that the only defense I have is that I'm really sympathetic to those kinds of questions. I wanted to just talk about. Enhancement, and if there's an inherent problem in that, and you're right. I mean, as a practical problem, that's immediate.
Material problems.
Yeah, right. Yeah, right. It acts exactly.
Yeah, two comments, and I really liked your question a lot. First is that technology, unlike science, is not, in my estimation, necessarily or inherently a good thing. Technology is a form of power. Power can be used for good or for ill, as we choose. And so that makes your question all the more pertinent. How are we going to persuade people to use technology in a good way? How are we going to provide universal or as close to universal access to this as we might be able to do? Well, those very important questions are exactly the reason why meetings like this, organizations like the MTA, organizations like transhumanism, various advocacy groups for emerging technology are important, because those groups are trying to address these questions, which are very real questions today. There's a lot, you know, we could talk about advanced nanotechnology and biotechnology 10, 20, 50 centuries down the road. But the only reason that the pragmatic people among us are talking about those things is because we see ourselves headed towards that future and want to pivot now rather than later. And so I guess my answer to your question in part is, yeah, it's a great question, and that's why we're doing what we're doing. The second answer that I've got for your question is that if you look at trends in the adoption and availability of technology, particularly as technology is enhanced with information technology in particular, and information technology is going into all sorts of other technological areas. For example, biotech is how it's making its way into biology and medical technologies. You see that the trends indicate that technology is being adopted more broadly, more quickly than ever before. And in fact, there's a marked trend, and that trend is exponential, very much like the progress of the computational capacity available to us is exponential. So there's reason for hope. Now, that doesn't mean we should stop talking about this and trying to figure out ways to make the situation better. That gives us maybe all the more reason to keep talking about it. But I don't think that we have to look at the past and assume that it will always be siloed to one or two or a group of important people. There's reason to believe that it can be more broad. Probably at first that it will be a few rich white guys.
But also in the case of GMO technology spreading across the world, across the global south, but there are good arguments that that is simply to centralize the power of creating materials in the global north. And so it's like, why should we celebrate the spread of that?
Yeah, technology itself is not what we should celebrate. What we should celebrate is universal human empowerment and our relationship with our environment that is necessary to achieve that empowerment. Technology is not inherently good. That's not the message that I'm trying to express.
Yeah. So, interject. We're down to the last 5 minutes, so the remaining questions, could you just add yes or no questions?
No.
Limit yourself to one quick question. We'll try to get to the four that we got right there. Okay.
Lincoln, could you give us the 30-second spiel on the difference between the moral perspective you hold to and utilitarian philosophy?
That's a loaded question, Joey. Yes, I wish the guy who asked that was still here. He's gone. Anyway, somebody please relay to him. No, I don't identify explicitly as a utilitarianist. And my moral philosophy is actually quite complex, but to do it briefly, it's quite similar to William James. It stems from this idea, basically, that humans have desires, and those desires, if I was the only person in the world, my desires would be what is good by definition, and anything contrary to those desires would be evil. But we live in a more complex world than that. There's disagreements, conflicts, and the moral system is one in which we seek to reconcile desires. In where we seek to reconcile knowledge, that's the project of science. We seek to reconcile our laws, that's the project of politics. Even our aesthetics, we're seeking to reconcile in art. I call that atonement, and we're all participating in it. So I'm not a utilitarianist. I think it's far more complex than that. But utilitarianism plays a role in that.
You nicely described this difference between this rapid expanding technological power and our moral development, how to use that. If we ask, why did God create this whole thing for us to become like Him? Is suffering, is negative experience, is weakness part of learning to become beings of love who can use this technology wisely? And if we use technology to get rid of all of that, can we still fulfill the purpose we're here for?
There's lots of questions in there. I don't pretend to know the thoughts of a God, but I do think that there's good reason to suppose that God is more benevolent than us. Again, check out the new God argument, another sales pitch for that for you.
I guess my question is, does this enhancement help us to become more God-like in love, or just this stronger people?
I don't think that we will ever overcome opposition or complexity or the need for progress. I don't think that enhancement ever gets us beyond those things. I think it introduces new challenges. And, you know, who knows what the problems of a god are? Who knows what the problems of a post-human are? I don't. But I suspect they have them. They've attained a level of complexity that just poses new challenges for them. So I don't think this is a question of getting rid of something that's been good for us. I think it's a question of how do we progress according to our desires to this new level of experience.
This is actually for Mark. So there's this dichotomy in your thought that's coming across between that which is organic and that which is artificial. And ironically, that to me seems a little bit artificial in the sense that organic, like what is organic other than that which was designed by a higher intelligent being?
Really quickly, I think there's room for, in Mormon theology, for there to be a lot that isn't designed by God. We believe in a pretty finite God. Well, I know there are different interpretations of and within Mormon. I tend to see God as finite. So there's plenty of room for the organic for me. You don't like that, do you?
I don't know too much about transhumanists, so this might be a silly question, but I've been thinking a lot lately about visions and technology, and really, like, kind of hard to explain, but kind of on a level, like, where do these visions really come from, you know, and how sort of it enhancements. If that, you know, not to sound all kooky, I am a practicing Mormon, you know.
It's hard to sound kooky in a room talking about transhumanism, yeah. So you're already out kooky.
I was just having this conversation yesterday in the car with my husband, and just real fascination. So my question is, what do kind of transhumanists think about, you know, technology and actual visions of technology, or just visions, you know, in the scope of Mormonism? That's my question.
Most transhumanists are secular, and most of those secular transhumanists are atheists and don't attribute visions or revelations or inspiration to God or anything along the lines of God. Yes, I will. However, among Mormon transhumanists, and we are a remarkable exception to the rule among transhumanists, there's a very broad set of perspectives on how revelation or inspiration might work technologically. I'll just throw one idea at you. I don't have any clue if this is true or not. But if post-humans are a sort of superorganism, then you and I actually might be anatomically part of God. You know, DNC 88 type thing comes to mind. And God is computing our world in the same way that you're computing thoughts during a dream. Computing is just a technical word for what our, you know, brains do biologically, right? It seems much more natural as we're dreaming. So, yes, there certainly are possibilities for explaining those sorts of things. I don't know what the right answer is, but there's lots of research going into how dreams work and such. What Michael just mentioned, October 1st of this year, the Mormon Transhumanist Association and the Transhumanist Alliance of Utah are sponsoring a conference at the University of Utah on transhumanism and spirituality. We will have a couple of the biggest names in the secular transhumanist world presenting at the conference. We'll have Terrell Givens presenting at the conference on the doctrines of theosis in Western civilization. We'll have a number of other very good speakers. And if these topics interest you, I invite you to come to that conference. It should be very productive. There's an advertisement for it, by the way.
Right above the description of this session.
Yeah, if you need the details for that.
Here, I want to thank Lincoln and Mark for this session. This concludes session 365. And we do finish up because there's feminists coming in here and they're talking.
Thank you.